Patrick J. Lamb, managing partner of Butler, Rubin, Saltarelli & Boyd, LLP, a Chicago-based litigation firm, was interviewed by Ed Pohl of Law Business Management in 2005 about value-added billing. The principles espoused by Patrick then are still applicable and fresh today.
Pat, thanks for joining us. Our topic is going to be alternative fees, and I'd like to start us off by asking you what that means to you. What's the definition of alternative fees as you use it?
Almost every lawyer who works for businesses bills by the hour. They set an hourly rate, and however many hours they work, they multiply that times their hourly rate. And there are variations on that where you may discount your hourly rate or blend it with others who are working with you. Those all fall into the hourly rate system. When I use the term alternative fees, I'm talking about a form of payment where your compensation is based on something other than an hourly rate. An example might be to have a fixed fee established at the beginning of a matter to handle it from beginning to end.
And I know that there are some other ways of using it besides a fixed fee. Would you say a capped fee is another approach, or in your mind, that's still part of the hourly format?
If you have an hourly rate not to exceed a certain number, it can qualify as an alternative fee, but it really is still based on a lawyer's hours spent on a matter, and that means a lawyer has an incentive to spend as many hours as is possible. And it's that incentive that's built into the hourly rate that puts the lawyer and his or her client at economic odds with one another. And so alternative fees really usually qualify for that label when they shift the economic incentive from being economic adversaries to being economic partners.
That's an interesting concept, and I know in my own practice as a law firm management consultant, frequently I'll freak out my clients, most of whom are used to hourly billing, as you say, by suggesting to them that they determine what my fee should be before we get started. Is that something that a lawyer can do? Is that an approach that might work for a lawyer, or are clients just not sophisticated enough to even come up with a number?
That's an approach that I would refer to as value billing. The client determines how much is this service going to be worth to me, and that's how much I'll agree to pay. I think that there are not many lawyers who are experienced in doing that, and in part it's because there aren't many clients experienced in demanding that. I do think that there's a chance that the industry may move ultimately in that direction. Other industries like accounting, to a certain extent, have moved in that direction, and there are some people who are strong advocates for that. That a client should not pay more than a service is actually worth. The question really is how do you determine worth without looking at it from the standard of how many hours are you going to spend working on this?
Well, historically speaking, is this something brand new, or have we had this in our profession years ago? I remember seeing an ad, for example, of Abraham Lincoln, who advertised his legal services in preparing a will for X number of dollars. It was a flat fee. That seems to be an alternative fee as we're defining it today. How did we get over, or when did we get over to the hourly billing?
As I've heard from a number of lawyers who are a bit older than I am, sometime in the 1950s, early 1960s, the hourly really became the vogue. Before that, what would happen is that a law firm would bill its client simply, one-line bill for services rendered, and that amount was frequently entered on the bill after the lead lawyer, the lawyer with the client contact, and the client sat down and talked about what services had been rendered and how much they were worth and what the value was. So an amount would be entered. As the amount of work, the number of areas in which work was done increased, it became harder to make those kinds of judgments. And so how much time the law firm had spent started to become a surrogate for value. And then over time, the notion of hourly rates and increasing those rates on almost a yearly basis became the industry standard.
Well, I know that you're an advocate of alternative fees and perhaps even of value billing, and you've had a significant influence by virtue of your position in your firm. How have you used this approach in the work that you do? And are you unique even within your firm, or is your firm moving in this direction?
I'll answer by saying my partners would tell you that I'm unique within our firm, and I'd probably be unique within any firm. But after they finish pulling my leg like that, I think they would acknowledge that we as a firm are starting to look for opportunities to do alternative billing. What we have done is we've done fixed fees with incentives. And I always think it's important whether you have part of your fixed fee held back or have some kind of defined bonus at the end, that there be something that you're working towards, that if you don't get a good result for your client, you suffer some pain. I call it having skin in the game. And I think that's required to keep everybody's attention on the same page, and that is the result that the client is entitled to. And we've done some of those. We've also done a straight fixed fee on what I would call pre-litigation consulting work that we do. Our firm is almost exclusively a litigation firm. We have entered into some work for clients where we've done it on a fixed fee and work leading up to or hoping to avoid lawsuits being filed.
Well, in order to do this, don't you have to have a pretty good fix on what your costs are? And if that's true, then the concept of budgeting has to come into play in this discussion, does it not?
It does if you want to make money while pursuing these kinds of fee arrangements. Anybody can quote a fixed fee, and you can lose an awful lot of money if you have to do a lot of work beyond what cost the fee covers. And so it's important to have an understanding about the amount of work that will be involved in any engagement. And in a lawsuit, that may mean how much work will your adversary make you do through discovery disputes or whatever, and how much the cost is to do that within your own firm. Not what the hourly rate is, but the actual cost, which is going to be considerably less than an individual lawyer's hourly rate. You need to know that. You need to, and it's a learned skill. You need to practice, and budgeting is the way you learn how to cost those items out.
And, of course, that's a skill we never learned in law school.
They don't teach you that in law school, and when you start working, everything about how you're judged is really contrary to the kinds of efficiencies you need to really succeed in an alternative fee arrangement. If I can offer this example, when I was a young lawyer, I would earn a lot more money if I worked a lot more hours. I would get a better grade or be judged better if I went through many more revisions, polishing a document till it was perfect, rather than having it be almost perfect. And so all of the incentives I had were to stay at the office later every night and to do more work on each assignment every night so that I was turning in the best possible work product. And that kind of incentive yielded very high hours, all of which were passed along to my firm's clients.
Well, in today's world, how does one get that education without costing the firm an arm and a leg, or worse, getting booted out by a client because of the billing process?
That is a very hard question to answer, because there's not an easy way to balance the firm's interest in having its lawyers become the best possible lawyers, and to do so on the client's nickel rather than their own nickel. You have to balance that against the desire to keep your client happy, to recognize the fact that on some matters, some refer to them as commodity matters, that the client doesn't need to have a Supreme Court quality brief filed on every issue. If you're filing a motion for an extension of time, just to pick an easy example, it doesn't matter if a more senior lawyer would have presented it in a more polished manner. As long as it's good enough to get the job done, that's what the client's interested in. And there are stories that you hear in the profession about clients getting mad at lawyers for literally billing too much time to prepare a simple motion like that. Or another one I heard recently was a lawyer had spent 18 hours preparing for a deposition of a 9-year-old who was simply being deposed to tell about how much it hurt to have lost his father in an industrial accident. No time should have been spent preparing for that kind of deposition because there wasn't any real need to take it. Those kinds of examples, I think, illustrate the client's reaction, and the firms have to adjust long-established ways of doing business in order to accommodate changing client interests.
Well, the example that you give, I think, is a really good one on one end of the spectrum. But on the other side of the spectrum, if the lawyer does not prepare, and I don't know that Supreme Court quality would be the appropriate metaphor here, but if one does not prepare and the results are not as desired, if you will, how is it that the lawyer can protect himself or herself from the complaints of the client that come in the form of malpractice actions?
That is exactly why, in my view, in order for an alternative fee arrangement to work on both sides, the lawyer has to have skin in the game. Because the lawyer needs to be able to answer your question by saying, I prepared as much as I needed to because I needed to have to be successful too. I'm going to not earn as much money if we're not successful. And so therefore, I invested the time that I thought was appropriate and that I would have spent had I been being paid the straight hourly rate. And as long as lawyers have that economic incentive and can show that it's a significant incentive, they would be protected from those kinds of Monday morning quarterback second-guessing situations.
You're talking about significant investment in the matter. What's your definition of significant? Are we talking 5%, 10%, 20%, or can you not put it in terms of percentage?
I think something, depending on the size of the matter, something in the order of 10 to 15 to 20% certainly would qualify as significant.
And in that case, are you suggesting that because the lawyer has the skin in the game, the client, though the client may legitimately have a complaint, won't put that complaint forward in a malpractice action? Is that what you're suggesting? Because if the client does put forth that claim, irrespective of the fee, the courts don't look at the fee when they make evaluation on malpractice claims, do they?
Right. If a lawyer screws up, he or she, is likely to get sued for malpractice, and that's the client's appropriate remedy. The fee arrangement is not designed to make the lawyers better lawyers or to make them qualified to do things that they aren't otherwise qualified to do. What it's designed to do is to eliminate the economic incentive to overbill a matter, to drag it on longer than it should be, to handle it in a way which yields lots of revenue for the lawyer at the expense of the client without regard to the result.
So we're really talking then about two separate issues. One is the fee, and the fee coincidentally with the lawyer having a stake in it may be sufficient to cause the client not to bring an action they might otherwise have. And the other issue is the quality of the work and whether in fact there's legitimate claim there for malpractice.
Right. Bad lawyers do not become good lawyers because they use a different fee arrangement.
Right. And the fee arrangement, though, may be sufficient to cause the client to believe that the lawyer has a better bedside manner and, like doctors, not quite as prone to a malpractice action. But it's not a guarantee.
It very well could have that effect.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the budgeting then in terms of the cost analysis and what we learn from that budgeting process when we're a little bit off. How do you deal with that? And how do you deal with the variance analysis that obviously has to come forth if you're measuring the actual results of costing versus what you thought it would be in the budgeting process?
That's a very complicated question in this regard. Everybody has to start somewhere, and everybody who starts knows that they're in a situation where they're new to the budgeting process and that it's an experience-driven process. I think everybody's had clients that have asked for budgets. You provide them budgets, and you may be wildly off at times. And as you do more and more of that, your margin of error, hopefully, if you're paying attention to what you're doing, becomes less and less. We started budgeting matters even where our clients didn't ask to have budgets so that we could develop a comfort level that our ability to estimate costs was satisfactory enough that if we pursued things on a flat fee basis, that we wouldn't find ourselves in situations where our estimates of how much it would cost to handle things would be wildly off, certainly not wildly off in a way which was adverse to the firm. And so by doing it more and more, by keeping data and mining that data, we've been able to refine our budgeting process, and I think now are fairly comfortable that we have a handle on understanding the costs, and the key is then applying our experience in a piece of litigation to how much that individual piece of litigation is likely to demand in terms of lawyer time. And once you have that experience and have developed a data, you know, sufficient amount of data and really mined it, I think you're in a position to provide some fairly tight budgets that you're willing to live with. And clients these days are now demanding that when you give a budget that you live with it, absent there being some kind of significant change in the lawsuit.
How is it that you provide for change orders using the construction industry by way of example? How is it that you make your assumptions clear to the client so that if later you have to go back to the client and say, well, based on the new information, we need to change and so forth, and it's in our fee has to be altered somewhat?
Well, I think that may vary according to each individual client, but the way to minimize the likelihood of that happening, of the need for change, is to specify all of the things that your budget is based on. For example, in a case where there's going to be a large number of documents that your client is giving to you and that you're going to then produce to the other side, you may say it's going to cost X dollars in order to retrieve those documents based on the assumption that you provide internally the manpower to show us exactly where all the documents are kept. If you get to a point where the client's not meeting its end of the bargain because people don't know where the documents are kept or there's a manpower shortage at the client's end or whatever, you go to the client and say, look, we made this budget estimate based on this assumption. It proved to be inaccurate because you weren't able to come through at your end. And so we're asking for an additional Y dollars to be added to that part of the engagement. There has to be an element of trust between the lawyer and client that you're not looking to gouge them in those situations and that they're comfortable that you're being fair with them. And in those situations where you have those kinds of things, I think clients, in my experience, have been very responsive to requests for changes. The key is to spell out in the maximum amount of detail possible the assumptions on which you're basing the budget you're providing.
I remember a comment once by Jack Welch, then chairman of General Electric, when he said, if a vice president cannot give me an analysis of his division on one page, then he doesn't know his business. And I think what he was saying is, in part, I'm so busy that I need as brief a picture as possible and yet very complete. How is it that a professional, a lawyer, can communicate with a client, somebody who's running a business, for example, in as brief a way as possible, and still have the bases covered sufficiently for the lawyer?
Part of the answer is, at what level are you developing the budget? If you're budgets, I don't think are developed on lawsuits at the Jack Welch level, which is fortunate because it would be hard to give a one-page explanation of a detailed budget on a piece of litigation. But having said that, you can certainly, there's a level of detail that would say, here are the 15 depositions we expect to take. Here's how much time we expect to spend preparing for each one, taking each one. That level of detail can become a little much. You can certainly say that we expect to prepare for and take 15 depositions, one line item. And then if that, if one deposition goes longer, one is shorter, the line item is still going to remain accurate. If the number of depositions changes materially, up or down, then you look at whether there's an adjustment that's needed. And part of the issue is, if you're looking for protection for increased amount of work, I think the fair thing is to be able to make adjustments to what you're expecting to be paid if there's a material adjustment on the downward side as well. And so, again, it gets back to the notion of lawyers and clients being fair with one another in terms of both the expectations and then the adjustment process as the lawsuit moves along.
The good lawyer really understood what the client wanted, not just what the client needed from the lawyer's perspective. And it seems to me that this whole concept of alternative fees or skin in the game gets us back to that process, does it not, of really looking at what the client wants and differentiating that from the need?
I think that's right, Ed. Clients have, and they've said this anecdotally to me, they've said it anecdotally to others, and those anecdotes have made their way to articles, and there's certainly been surveys, have talked about the demands that have been placed on them by their bosses and their business processes, and invariably the budget demands on them, creating a budget for the legal department, staying within that budget, are issues that almost every in-house lawyer has to deal with in one way or another. And so a lot of the alternative fee movement is born of a desire to help in-house lawyers deal with that internal problem, as well as to make the administration of a given lawsuit or series of lawsuits easier for them. And if you're effective at creating the right arrangement, I think it makes everybody's life a lot easier, and hopefully it makes the relationship that much more of a enduring one. And that's, after all, what both sides, I think, are looking for, a successful relationship, but one in which there's a degree of trust on both sides that you'll help each other through the issues that both of you have to deal with.
And that, I think, is perhaps one of the best definitions of loyalty that I've heard yet, and loyalty, it seems to me, is what we're all looking for in our relationships with our clients. The buzzword of exceeding client expectations, I think, has come and gone, and people are now recognizing that what we're really talking about is loyalty, that if there's an issue, both the lawyer and the client can come to the table and talk
and
about
to the
table
fear
and talk and know
about without
that they
fear,
have enough
and know
what's
the
that
word,
they have enough
what's
emotional,
the word,
emotional
to raise the issues,
safety,
to raise the issues,
adverse economic consequences of losing the relationship.
Consequences of losing the relationship.
It's like any other relationship. The more trust, the more loyalty, the more commitment, the better off the relationship will be in the long run.